Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you this Wednesday morning, June 4th. It is a mild one out there again, Matt. These early morning drives out here to the KVY studios are quite nice when it's overcast. You know, it's been great these last few days.
I was at the point where thinking there might be a drop of rain or two on somebody's car. Those clouds just look just enough to maybe just throw out a random drop of rain or two.
Yeah, what awesome weather we've had these last few days. That
tropical
rain on
Storm Alvin, baby.
Yeah, that rain on Sunday was unbelievable, unseasonable, not great for business. Of course, those of us in the patio business aren't always thrilled to see that rain, but as everybody says here, we need it in the desert. And it's been sort of a nice little reprieve from summer to actually have Tucson's weather be pretty mild. You know, I look at some of my friends in the Midwest and it's just as cool in Tucson as it had been in the Midwestern United States.
Not exactly what you'd expect from Memorial Day weekend until the beginning of June, but we'll take it. It's enjoy it while it lasts, right?
Absolutely. Well, we are certainly in the deep throes of summer, but that doesn't mean things aren't happening here in Pima County. On your food for thought on the top four things you need to know today. First and foremost, in the news yesterday after the Pima County Board of Supervisors meeting, which I had the pleasure of attending about the first 5 hours of or so to get a little call to the public about the Rito Downs, and we'll talk about that on the next segment over here, but the Pima County Main Library is on the move. The Board of Supervisors have voted to spend $6.2 million to acquire the Wells Fargo Bank and move the Valdez Library across the street. Now, they were talking about the potential cost of improving the existing library between $77 and $82 million. This must be the same contractor that did the bowling alley property. I'm not sure. I'm a little concerned about that
one. It's called ARPA Construction, I think.
Yeah, I think we're all in the wrong business over here. I am going to officially quit the restaurant business and become the county construction business.
Margins
right now
might be better.
I am going straight into that one over there, accepting bids now, Pima County Board of Supervisors. Hey, look, it's going to be an expensive project either way. Retrofitting old buildings is not for the faint-hearted. It's interesting to see all these bank properties popping up, right? What gem of properties when you think of that, you know, Valley National Bank, just Chase property on Congress that Dan Scordato has turned into the Treasury. Super, super awesome. Right, as I mentioned on last week's show, I've got a Chase Bank under contract at Campbell and Grant, and we're working our way trying to make that particular property legal for food service in some capacity. I've got a meeting with City Developmental Services tomorrow at 2:30 to see how that goes. So fingers crossed on that one. And now this Wells Fargo Bank as well, too. A pretty cool property. I mean, a pretty iconic piece of Tucson, and that's about to become our library. I don't know exactly when that opening date might be for this, but obviously we're still talking about millions of dollars even to retrofit that
building. They said 26 to 27 mil to retrofit it, which who knows what that means when the final price tag comes in. Yeah, not insignificant.
Yeah, remember that number because I'd like to see what that final price tag looks like. I just always remember those Pima County Supervisor meetings where Supervisor Miller at the time was saying, why are we always on the wrong side of things? Every time we sell, it's at the absolute worst part of the market. And every time we buy, it's at the highest high of the market. And it's a pretty unfortunate circumstance. And it's one reason the government often shouldn't be in the real estate business.
The bowling alley, which now houses our favorite people, the food inspectors.
We love the Pima County Health Department. Yes, absolutely.
That started off being a $7 million proposition, build property and renovations combined, and it ended up being 40. So, yeah.
But we do have that really nice block wall and bowling sign over there, too,
clearly,
with the pins.
Clearly,
so, I mean, there's value
that's
there.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, let's not forget about that one.
An expensive lava rock.
Either way, attending the Board of Supervisors meetings really helped open my eyes. I do get to a few of these ones as we have liquor license hearings and things of that nature, which generally make their way onto the consent agenda and aren't super, super hot topics. But you always kind of want to shepherd your applications through the finish line. So I'm no stranger to having been to these meetings. But yesterday was quite eye-opening to see just how far left of center we are right now as well on the Board of Supervisors. Essentially, with Matt Hines and Cano and Jen Allen with three votes, they can pass pretty much unilaterally just about anything they want to do. And it was very clear to me that the decisions were already made well in advance. Nothing could have been made more clear than that. then the fact that these very expensive tax votes that we were talking about, or that you talked about at the top of the hour, right? The move in to $8.5 million to spend on you know, the unhoused or an affordable housing in some capacity, up from $5 million, were taken at 10:30, basically before the call to the public. And the reason was that Supervisor Hines wasn't present for the first hour and a half of the meeting and essentially showed up just in time for this agenda item that he had placed on there. So they allowed two or three call to the public people, cut it short, and then voted for, you know, some very expensive tax increases before this call was even had. And I think that's a bit unfortunate. I know these decisions were probably made ahead of time. Nobody's sitting there at the call to the public and suddenly probably being swayed by the fact that one or two people showed up to complain about their taxes going up in some capacity. But I think you at least have to give the optic, right? You've got to sell that to the general public that we are here, in fact, to listen. I did feel bad for Supervisor Scott, and he handled it pretty well because there were a few people that were quite disrespectful at those meetings. And it always like is really impressionable upon me when you see somebody up there swearing and dropping F-bombs or yelling or talking out of turn. And Supervisor Scott handled that one quite well, both chiding right and left of center people quite fairly to maintain a semblance of decorum for our Board of Supervisors. And I think that's something that we all should remember as well, too, that no matter what you think about the politics over here, these people are putting their neck out on the line to do these kind of jobs. And the last thing they need to do is get absolutely beat up or berated with F-bombs, particularly in such a public forum. So it's often a rough crowd over there. I've experienced it quite a few times. Nobody ever wants to know how the sausage is made here when it comes in politics. But I truly think that we're going to be in a somewhat troubling time here in Pima County where we're lacking balance in the same way that the city of Tucson lacks balance. You know that the politics are going to be left of center. And for a lot of our listeners, that might not line up where you want to be politically. But what you do want to see is some sort of balance, right? A first and a second, a little bit of talk about what's going to happen over here. Put people on the record to vote for things rather than just the city council manner in which it's just nearly a unanimous vote every single time, time and time again. It's quite unfortunate, and I think we're going to see more and more of that one when it comes to the Board of Supervisors. As well in the news earlier this week, Hedrick Akers wins in court, right? An appeals court over here in a case that they had originally lost. Neighbors that got together using the law firm Tully Bailey to sue the city of Tucson over their response to the unsheltered population living in the Navajo Wash and somewhat terrorizing these neighbors of Hedrick Akers. The city of Tucson was originally ruled not liable for this because their tiered encampment system, where they basically gave them a grade of 1, 2, or 3. This is a pretty scientific numbering system over here, in case you were wondering. And what exactly defines a 1, 2, or 3? I'm not exactly sure. That system sounds like a number 2 to me. But Hedrick Akers gets the opportunity to now hold the city liable for their inaction. And it's great to see, because this firm was the same firm that sued the city of Phoenix for the zone too. The exact same group and under a similar legal theory. And now that combined with Proposition 312, which of course, as everybody has on their home scorecard, is the property tax rebate for non-enforcement of municipal nuisance laws. Right. Bill, right? A real mouthful over there. But now that that's passed as well too, I think we're going to see a little bit different city of Tucson over here. There's going to be a little more pep in their step when it comes to responding to these. Mm-hmm. And you may see other neighborhoods stick up for this one as well, too. And I'm certain we're going to see a number of businesses end up filing property tax rebate requests, which is going to fill up our court systems a little bit as well, too. I mean, I expect to see hundreds, if not thousands, of these once the process is figured out. Again, most people don't know how this works. Ultimately, a business could file, and if the city does not respond inside of 30 days, you're just granted a victory. But if they do, the city attorney chooses to challenge this, and I expect they would, right? You would want to save that money if you could. Then there ends up being a hearing. And so the critics of this particular bill were concerned that this was going to clog up the court systems. And I think it's safe to say that we're going to see a number of responses on this one. I can already think of just on our Maverick property on the east side, we keep building a big new fence on the backside to protect the Maverick from the old Corleone's building and the homeless encampments that are building up over there and these sort of Section 8 apartments that exist behind us. And the fences are continuously cut down and there continues to be mattresses and shopping carts and whatnot built through it. And the people actually cut through my brand new fence with bolt cutters all to avoid having to walk around the block to access these particular either encampments or apartments. And it happens time and time again. And again, these are situations where we've called and reported these particular encampments and just nothing happens in the city of Tucson.
That was, that was the thing that when I spoke with Mr. Wuhr from the Hedrick Acres neighborhood about the lawsuit yesterday, that's what I got from him. In action. They've talked to the city. They've tried to be partners with the city. They've, you know, hey, what can we do? And then all of a sudden they get ghosted.
Yes.
And then things escalate to lawsuits.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure that there was a grade on that, a one, two, or three out there from the city in some capacity. But either way, a win for the residents of Hedrick Acres. And I think in the long term, this is going to be a win for the city of Tucson as it gets us back to the focus that I think is on most people's minds. No matter where you stand politically, we need to have our streets, we need to have our bus stops, we need to have our parks, and we need to have our washes safe for our family and children. Why don't we take a quick break over here, Matt? We've got a great show coming up for you. However, at about 7:30, we're going to have CD7 candidate Daniel Hernandez coming in. We've got Rich Pfeiffer from General Ben's Basio and Agave House at the 8 o'clock hour. You're listening to Grant Krueger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Krueger. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us here on The Morning Voice. You know, lots of neat things still happening over here. There's always Tucson-related news. I always laugh how, like, in the news cycles, we make things Tucson-centric, even on a national level. But I do think that there are a couple pieces out here from a sports perspective that tie into that, right? First and foremost, the NBA Finals start tomorrow night. And we're excited. A couple Arizona Wildcats playing on the Indiana Pacers. So I imagine we're going to see a lot of newfound Tucson Pacers fans rooting for TJ McConnell and Benedict Mathurin from the Pacers. And the Arizona baseball team, like we talked about last week, has made the Super Regionals of the College World Series. They're going to play the evil Tar Heels of North Carolina starting this Friday, Saturday, and if necessary, Sunday. All those games are early because they're playing in East Coast time.
9
over there.
O'clock? So, yeah, 9 Friday, o'clock. Is that right?
Yeah, breakfast starts. If you're going to watch that one,
kegs and eggs over at Union.
You have to start drinking early. How can you drink all day if you don't start in the morning?
And you don't have to just hate North Carolina Tar Heels for basketball now.
Yes.
So, you know, we can hate them for other sports.
So the Super Regionals are essentially the Sweet 16 of college baseball, and they move forward in like a best of three series onto then, let's call it the Elite Eight, and that is your College World Series.
That's right.
It always takes me a while to kind of figure that one out because it's so different than other baseball or other even pro sports playoffs where they're best of five or best of seven series, and these are much more truncated, shorter series. It's a best of three, you know, win or go home sort of thing, and your Arizona Wildcats are playing this Friday starting at 9 a.m., so give those guys a holler. In other Arizona Wildcat news, R.A. McDonald was signed, right, with the Indiana Fever. I'm not normally
one. Isn't that awesome?
She played last night, Matt, as well, too. She came off the bench, had 7 points, 5 assists, and 3 steals in 27 minutes in the Fever's first victory since Caitlin Clark was injured. Yeah. So super cool to see R.A. McDonald
backfilling a phenom like Caitlin Clark. Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely.
But R.A. McDonald, I'm telling you, she was certainly once in a generation talent. I mean, she was just amazing at the U of A. And so how appropriate that, you know, one of the U of A's most dynamic players that took them to the final game of the NCAA Women's Championship is backfilling for Caitlin Clark, who is, you know, just a phenom herself. So really neat.
Absolutely. So I hate to be the shill for Tucson and making the Tucson, you know, news part of national news over here, but it is kind of cool to see Wildcat players filling both the NBA finals and filling such a dynamic role in a WNBA team as well, too. So bear down, all you listeners out there. Now, I did want to give you guys a bit of a Rito Park update. That was part of the reason I was hanging out with the Pima County Board of Supervisors. As much as I'm sure Matt Hines wants to hang out with me over there, I wanted to pitch my wares because there happened to be a little line item, number 22 on the agenda yesterday, that said FC Tucson Soccer Update. Nothing more than that, right? Kind of innocuous. It makes you think we'd be talking about the team, or how many goals.
You might be talking about Keno Sports Park or across the street from TEP or something.
Nope, but a little birdie had told me that this was actually a thinly disguised plan to potentially announce a replacement or elimination of the Rito Park. And so myself and a few racing aficionados, including Robert Hartman, who's the head of the racetrack industry program at the University of Arizona, showed up to pitch our support for the track and find ways to potentially keep this track going, in spite of the fact that, as I'm sure you've seen all over the news, nobody applied for this RFP to be the operator. And I let the county know in no uncertain terms that this was going to be a We Are the World album of fixes to make this happen. We're going to need county support, we're going to need city support, we're going to need state support, possibly even the newly created Sports, Tourism, and Film Authority, and most likely some support from the university as well, too, to get this done through their RTIP, Racetrack Industry Program, to make this happen for the Rito Downs. Now, the county never paid for this property to begin with. I did quite a bit of Rito research and history, just having volunteered and worked at that track. Like, I'm sure you know that, you know, the Jelks farm, for example, right, was Rukin Jelks, and Melville Haskell, who were the original founders of the Rito Downs, started in 1943. So we're talking 82 years ago when they started this particular racetrack. What I didn't know was that they actually sold it by 1953 to a corporation that was owned by local famous Detroit mobster and later City of Tucson mobster Peter Licavoli. And so the mob basically ran the track in the early to mid 1950s in Tucson before Licavoli got into tax problems with the federal government in 1956, and they began to audit him, and he slowly had to divest his interest in the track. It was acquired by a New York real estate firm called Emprise in 1965, and they ran the track somewhat not profitably until 1971, where they gifted it, in lieu of a bunch of taxes, of course, to Pima County. And Pima County acquired that portion of the track as a gift from the Emprise Corporation in 1971. This Jelk stud farm was gifted at the estate of, you know, one of the original owners passing away in 2006, and was bequeathed to the county at that point, sort of unifying the property again. So at the end of the day, the taxpayers' money hasn't really gone that far into the Rito Downs. Both of these particular properties were essentially gifted to the county in some capacity. But yesterday, Ted Schmidt, who's a well-known attorney and big soccer promoter and part of a 15 or 20 year fight about whether soccer or horse racing should exist at the park, put out a presentation showing how we should make the Rito Park like Naranja Park, to have a splash pad and have bigger swing sets under shade and more amenities for kids. Now, I can't argue against splash pads, parks, amenities for kids, or soccer, right? That would be like arguing against the Humane Society. Like, who doesn't like puppies? It'd be like arguing against an ice cream store. Who doesn't like ice cream, right? Like, I recognize that there are needs like this, and those are super cool things, and I am 100% for those things. But I'm also for some degree of historic preservation for a track that was the birthplace of quarter horse racing in southern Arizona, for a track that was the birthplace of the photo finish in the early 1950s. It was truly the mafia creating this photo finish, right? Using camera technology at the time to determine which horse was a hair away from winning or losing, to add some legitimacy to the betting side of things on the horse track. I'd love to learn even more about the mafia history of Tucson. If there are any listeners out there that have some experience with that and want to come on the show and talk about that, I feel like this is a topic that I've just been absolutely dying to explore over here, as I think there's so much neat stuff there, and that sort of soft white underbelly of how things actually get done over here in the desert. But either way, There's a lot to be said about the history of this particular track and its importance to quarter horse racing and in basically the entire United States. And I think there's a way that we can have our cake and eat it too. It's going to be a multi-headed approach, as we said, though. This is going to have to literally have some state participation to help unlock some state funds for this. It's going to really need the U of A as well, too. It's going to need the private sector to step in, but not in a way that Pima County had put it out in their RFP. I told the Board of Supervisors yesterday, when you announced just a 3-year deal, and that's it, there's no renewal options, there's no like way to recuperate that investment, who's going to put millions of dollars, or at least high hundreds of thousands of dollars, into a big old building like that, and then have the county pull the plug on you inside of 3 years? You would never recapitalize your investment. It would be insane. It's kind of like the insanity we talk about in restaurants all the time, where people lease these properties and put a multi-million dollar TI into a leased property that you don't own. You better stick around for a long time. Like, you better be there literally for years, decades in some capacity, to make this pencil out. Otherwise, you should just buy tax-free muni bonds. You should just stick this thing in an S&P 500 Vanguard indexed fund, you know, some sort of no-load mutual fund that ekes out a 4.5% return for you and be done. You should absolutely not go into the restaurant, hospitality, or racetrack business if you've only got 3 years. So I'm hoping that the county supervisors pay attention to that one over there. We shall see. There's going to be updates on this one for sure coming across the summer, as I hear a little birdie telling me there could be a track potentially under construction in the city of Marana. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to have Daniel Hernandez, Democrat candidate for Congress, CD7, coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Cruz and Matt Neely on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. Every Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 a.m., you get to deal with me, bringing you all kinds of business news, local politics, and the way those things sort of intersect. On Mondays, we've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, we've got Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council and his engagement hour. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And then finally, Dr. Ed Ackerley, bringing you all sorts of neat things from the University of Arizona on Fridays. As I was checking the news over the last couple days, I saw the saga of EGs continuing over here. And it was announced that all 25 EGs franchises were purchased by a group called the EGs Acquisition Company. Now, instantly, like, my neck hair sort of stands up when I think EG's Acquisition Company. Well, what is this company that has bought one of our local most hallowed brands over here? And can they drive this out of the financial quagmire that they're in? Well, of course, EG's Acquisition Company is nothing more than a name for the Gladstone Capital Corporation, which is a large investment firm. According to Wikipedia over here, Gladstone Capital Corporation is a business development company that invests in debt and equity securities of lower middle market businesses in the United States. It provides financing to these companies through various loan structures like senior term loans, subordinated loans, and revolving loans. This definitely sounds like a company that's going to be able to fix EG's ranch. Like, there is just no question over here. Sarcasm intended. I'm not so sure that the Gladstone Capital Corporation is going to be the white knight that we're hoping for to save such a well-loved Tucson brand over here, right? They've got 25 stores. And when I look at Gladstone's holding, it's a lot of senior living and real estate portfolios. There's not a ton of restaurants in here. These guys don't necessarily seem to be restaurant specific. And that always scares me. If you're not in this business, if you're not doing this regularly, if it's a side hustle for you, it generally doesn't work so well. And even for a big company, because Gladstone is publicly traded, right? You can buy their stock. It's GLAD on NASDAQ over here for those keeping track at home. But if you're looking to short this one, maybe. But I'm really concerned that our local beloved brand, which is already, I think, in the eyes of social media, taken a turn for the worse, right? There's already been a lot of knocks on food quality in some capacity. There does seem to be a bit of love for the original owners, you know, the Ed Irving Slice and Ice over here. Has that second location opened up yet in Tanque Verde?
Not yet, but they are making progress on the building, Tanque Verde, near Camino Principal. Yeah,
yeah, I drive by it all the time, and it just doesn't quite look open yet to me.
Yeah, he was talking midsummer, it sounded like. So I'm not going to start, you know, going on Slice and Ice watch until probably July or late July.
Right. We're going to have to put a Slice and Ice watch over here, a countdown in some capacity, you know.
And I don't like to, you know, kick EG's around. You know, I agree with you. They're a great local brand, right? A great history. But my observation as an EG's, you know, customer is that they've kind of made some tweaks on the food and the slushies a little bit. And you can just tell it's a little different. And, you know, they rebranded all the buildings. They got rid of the kind of the brown and mustard kind of motif, the 70s looking motif, you know. And then they went with more of a modern aquamarine and white and changed the signage and everything like that. So the look is a little bit different. And they've made some tweaks to the food. And I hope they can put it back together because obviously they've built over 50 years. They've built up quite a brand around town.
No, as previously stated, I love my EG.
Sure.
Still stuck in the
Absolutely.
70s too, particularly. Like there's like outside of perhaps the Red Bull Angels showing, dropping off Red Bulls to my kitchen staff every once in a while, which is pretty much like the pinnacle of their happiness. In the summer months, I tend to try to buy them EGs, you know, like to surprise them with
yes.
a big party pack. I particularly have been a fan of watermelon EGs, right? July 1 comes, it's hot as Hades outside, and suddenly you walk into the kitchen with a party pack
You're
of EGs.
You're a very popular man at that point.
Very much so. Our brand equity, our stock goes up at that point. I don't know about Gladstone Capital over here, but our stock as Union Hospitality Group goes up quite a bit when we can walk into a hot kitchen on July 1st or 2nd or 3rd with a big old party pack or tub of watermelon EGs for sure.
I saw somebody I know walked into a Discount Tire on a very hot August afternoon with a party pack of EGs, and I observed the reactions of the Discount Tire personnel. They were very, very happy.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that Gladstone can dig EG's out of the mess that they're in right now. It's a 25-store group, right? They'd expanded up into the Phoenix market as well, too, where the previous ownership had some troubles. And so I think this is going to be a difficult, difficult battle. We've had a number of sandwich shop-owning guests on this show before, and that sandwich market is crowded. That is a crowded field. It's like being in the hamburger market. Like, there is just a lot of competitors and a lot of price ceilings because of those competitors as well too. And EG's has kind of changed their formula even in terms of the sizing on the food. I think there was a lot of complaints about how they got rid of the 8-inch sub and went to like this 6 and 12. And so there's no like tweener size. It's
right,
like, do you
right.
want to eat a whole thing of fries and a giant tub of EG's and a 12-inch sub? Like, can you do that?
If I could give them one piece of constructive criticism, and again, this is coming from a fan, so I'm not hating on them. Go back to the pastrami sub with the rye bread roll, okay? And they're doing them all grinder style now. And before it was just the pastrami, the pickle, the ribbon of mustard on it, and cheese if you wanted it. And it was simple and it was really good. And now they're doing it grinder style with all the dressing and lettuce and all that stuff. And for pastrami, I think go back to the original on that one. I think that would be a good move.
There is some culinary advice from Mr. Matt Neely there as well, too. But point well taken. I mean, EG's, I think, is going to have to really do a great spin job over here to dig themselves out of this mess. And it's an unfortunate thing because I love to see local Tucson brands go out there and kick some butt.
Of course.
Right? Like, it gives me like a fair bit of satisfaction to see Fox Restaurant Corporation, you know, whose genesis started in Tucson, Arizona, go out and literally become a national brand. And yes, they sold to the Cheesecake Factory and all the things. It's not quite the same company it was a couple decades ago when Sam Fox started it. But it's still pretty awesome to see Tucson brands go out there and just execute on the highest level and go into a Phoenix market, or in Fox's case, heck, they're in Dallas and Newport and Atlanta and Washington, D.C. I mean, they're truly on a national stage and doing incredibly well. And I'm always a big fan when those sort of things happen as well, too. We're still waiting to see if we'll get Mr. Daniel Hernandez in here. He is currently in Washington, D.C. right now. We're waiting on his call-in. On the news, though, this morning when I woke up on the Arizona Republic, I get to be in the paper again on the ye olde egg lawsuit.
Okay, what's going on there?
So ultimately, the governor has decided to punt on the implementation of these particular cage-free mandates on chickens until the year 2032. And so I don't want to say that I won this case, and I need to be careful here. Let me give a little background for the listeners. There's a lawsuit about animal husbandry and whether or not the State Department of Agriculture can make laws outside of the legislative branch of the government. And I sued them to see if they could do that, and it looks like they most likely can't. Attorney General Chris Mays put me through a four-hour deposition about 4 weeks ago, which was a special treat. But ultimately, they've delayed the implementation of this law now until 2032, recognizing that there probably are legal troubles with it. And as such, the Attorney General has asked Judge Staley in the case, the Maricopa County Superior Court judge, to do a stay, which is basically punting, saying, well, why is this even a case anymore if we've delayed the implementation an additional 7 years in some capacity? Now, I still think this deserves to be a case and deserves to have its full day in court in some capacity, because as a restaurateur, you know, we had our teeth kicked in pretty heavily in the COVID crisis, and we had it kicked in by groups like the Department of Health Services, unelected bureaucrats making laws shutting down the private sector. And while I get the good intentions the first couple weeks of COVID and I give everybody a hall pass, in the long term, this is a real problem for us if we continue to allow unelecteds to make laws outside of the legislative branch, right? If these laws about animal husbandry were made by our state legislators, there are 30 legislative districts, Matt. Every single one of them has some agrarian component to it, almost. And as such, wouldn't the lawmakers have carried that weight with them to understand, like, how these laws need to be made with respect to farmers and people that are actually in the business?
By people who represent farmers.
Yes.
In a lawmaking capacity. Yeah.
Very much so. And adding to the pressure on egg prices, in the news late last week, the Hickman Egg Ranch announced
I was just pulling that article up. We ran it on our news. 95%, right?
Yeah, of their stock of chickens had to be put down because of the laws with respect to preventing the spread of this avian flu as well, too. And so the upward pressure on egg prices is going to continue. I think it's going to continue to be a problem, not just for the restaurant industry, but for everyone's homes, and the prices of such important food items like this are going to continue to rise. And so I'm proud to have been part of this particular lawsuit in a way to limit government interference in the private sector that I think makes it cost more on everybody's plate, whether it's in your house or in your favorite restaurant. Why don't we take another quick break over here, Matt, and we'll see if we can get Mr. Daniel Hernandez on the line when we come back. You're listening to Matt Neely and Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. It is a great Wednesday morning for you out over there in the Old Pueblo. We are waiting for a call in from Mr. Daniel Hernandez, who is going to be a candidate for CD7, right? Running for Congress. Like, this is no small feat. And I always appreciate people when they step up to run for such a big position like this in some capacity. And I think we've got him on the line right over here, right now in the KVUI studios. Good morning, Mr. Hernandez, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
No, thanks for jumping on The Morning Voice with me. Really excited to have you here this morning.
Yeah, sorry for being a little late. The joys of flying, everything gets delayed.
Oh, yes. There's plenty of joys in flying these days. I understand you're in Washington, D.C. You're heading to Washington, D.C. right now?
Yeah, I just landed. I'm here for the Equality Pack Gala, so I'm excited to be here, although red eyes are not as fun as they used to be.
No, I didn't think they were fun to begin with, Daniel. So just about as fun as politics, I imagine, right?
You know, I think for me, I've been doing this since I was 18 years old and I got elected at 21. So I've gotten a little used to it, but it is certainly not for the faint-hearted.
No, why don't we talk about your background a little bit for listeners that don't know who Daniel Hernandez is? Can you break down your start in politics for us?
Yeah, so my dad was a construction worker. My mom's a Mexican immigrant. I grew up in a working class family here in Tucson, and at 18 realized the power of advocacy. So I started lobbying at the Arizona State Legislature for affordable and accessible higher education, passed my first bill when I was 20 years old, got elected to the Sunnyside School Board at 21 and started working on tackling corruption and nepotism. And then at 24, survived a recall attempt and recalled two of my fellow board members. So I became the youngest president ever in the Sunnyside School Board. And then in 2016, got elected to the Arizona State House, where I spent three terms representing Southern Arizona. So I've been doing this for a long time, a very old 35.
Right, I see it. And you had beat in that race Chris Ackerley, who for a while was Pima County treasurer over there, and then successfully sort of defended that two times, right?
Yeah, so I beat Ackerley, who is a Republican, and was able to hold on to the seat for two terms. And now my sister, Gonzalo, serves in the Arizona State House. So we've had a lot of great people who have served in this district. And I think for me, it was important to be able to show that being in the minority, you can still get stuff done. And it's going to be important, I think, if I win in this election in Congress, to make sure we're delivering for Southern Arizona, because I think we can't wait until people are in the majority to be able to get results. And I think that's the thing that I've always been able to do, whether it was a school board member or as a legislator, actually working on solving problems for working families here in Southern Arizona.
Without a doubt. Now, that election's coming up, too. Like, this isn't like a normal November cycle over here, right? The general election, I believe, is September 23rd, and the primary is July 15th. Is that correct?
July 15th, with ballots going out June 18th. So we are right around the corner from ballots dropping.
Right. That's like 2 weeks, essentially, almost to the day right now, being the 4th, I guess, right?
Yep. 2 weeks exactly.
So what have you got cooking for these next couple of weeks to get out there and get people excited about the Daniel Hernandez campaign?
So we are knocking on doors all the time. So if folks want to sign up to volunteer, they can go to daniel4arizona.org. We're also really excited about an event we have coming up with you in a couple of days. Do you want to say the details or do you want me to say them?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so on June 9th at 5:30, we're going to be at Union Public House hosting a fundraiser for my campaign, where people can come, hear great music, have some great food from Union Public House, but also hear about the important stakes in this election to make sure we elect somebody who's going to be able to deliver for Southern Arizona.
Yeah, love it. I think it'd be a great opportunity for people to get out there and meet you and your family. I mean, what a long history in politics over here, because you've got another sister as well, too, in the State House, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so Alma and Gonzalo are the first sisters to ever serve in the legislature together. And Alma and I were the first brother and sister to ever serve in the legislature. So there has been a Hernandez representing at least one portion of Southern Arizona since 2011.
Which makes sense then to run for Congress as well, too. You're the first, though, of your family to run for Congress?
Yes. And, you know, I think the big thing is I spent 8 years as a school board member and 6 as a legislator. And now I have two sisters that are doing a great job fighting for Southern Arizona and Phoenix. And they're the only ones that know how to get bills done. And they are getting a lot of traction on their bills in the legislation, which is rare for Democrats, especially in a Republican majority in the legislature.
No, that's one of the things I've always appreciated about your sister Alma, is her ability to reach out across the aisle as well, too. She was a big proponent of our restaurant tip bill, that Senate concurrent resolution that helped get passed across the finish line. And though we didn't win on the ballot for that one, she really helped stick up for restaurants quite a bit. And we definitely remember and appreciate those things.
My sisters are the best. And I, even if I wasn't their brother, I would, you know, be touting how great they are, because they are effective, they're thoughtful, and I think they're the most important legislators Southern Arizona has had in decades.
No, you guys are a very strong political family over here, and it's going to take a mountain to beat the sort of incumbent family on this one as well, too. It's a 5-horse race in this Democrat primary, but I think for most political pundits, they're looking at this one as a 2-horse race over here as well, too. We're going to have to take a quick break over here for CBS Newsbreak. Do you got time to stick around for one more segment, or are you off in your travels right now? Why don't you stick around? We'll have one more segment when we come back after the break with Democrat candidate for CD7, Mr. Daniel Hernandez.
And Grant, if you want to vote in the Democratic primary for the CD7 special primary, you need to, and you're not registered, you do need to register to vote by June 16th, which is just right around the corner.
So you can still get out there and register to vote. We're going to have one more segment with CD7 candidate Daniel Hernandez coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Daniel Hernandez on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, and we've got about five more minutes over here with special guests calling in from Washington, D.C., candidate for CD7, that congressional seat in Southern Arizona, Mr. Daniel Hernandez. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be back on.
No, thanks again. I know you've got just a few minutes before you've got to meet a House member over there, so we appreciate you taking time out of your Wednesday morning to discuss your campaign with us over here.
Yeah, I'm excited because I think right now what we really need to focus on is making sure we're lowering cost of living for people in Southern Arizona and the West Valley. Our district goes from Avondale and Tellison all the way to Yuma and Bisbee. So I think lowering cost of living and making sure we're creating good jobs for people is so critical right now. And that's where I've spent my entire career as an elected official, trying to lower costs for everyday working families, like the family that I grew up in here in Tucson.
Without a doubt, one of the things that I took note of during the debate that you guys held at the end of May, just a few days ago, was how you and your sister sort of stood up against the Proposition 414, which was the city of Tucson's special sales tax election over here. And you guys were some of the lone wolf Democrats to really stand out against this one. Can you tell me about that position?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important for people to understand is that when people are hurting and the economy is not in great shape, the last thing we need to be doing is raising taxes on the working poor and on people on fixed income. So that's why I was proud to oppose Prop 414. I wish that the city would do a better job of actually managing their finances, because I know when I have things that I need to pay for and I don't have the money, that doesn't mean I go and ask for more. I figure out how I adjust my budget. And unfortunately, public safety and the fire and police department are underfunded woefully here in the city of Tucson. So instead of calling people who are the poorest in our community to pay and foot the bill, we should be finding solutions at the city level. I think that's one of the reasons why voters rejected it soundingly. You know, the Adelita tax hike was something that voters rejected, because this is something that people can't afford right now. And we really need to do more to lower cost of living, not try and increase it like other people did just a few weeks ago.
Without a doubt. I mean, that proposition went down 70-30, which was sort of a mandate over there. Like, most of the time, things aren't that, you know, decisive when it comes to politics.
It's not surprising when voters sent a very clear message in November that they were worried about the economy, that when a few months later the city tried to raise taxes in March, that it failed. So I'm proud to have opposed it. And I think now what we need to do is find real solutions to try and lower the cost of living for everyday Tucsonans and people across CD7.
What other solutions would you have, you think, that would differentiate you from the somewhat crowded field with five candidates running for this particular seat over here? Like, what differentiates Daniel Hernandez from the others?
I think the biggest thing is you can't say that you support workers if you don't support the work that they need to have jobs to feed their families. And that's why I'm proud to be endorsed by the Laborers Union, by folks like the Teamsters, because I'm not just supporting the idea of workers, I'm supporting the work that they need to be able to actually be able to provide for their families. So, you know, very excited about this opportunity. And hopefully people can join us on Monday the 9th at 5:30 at Union Public House to hear a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm excited to get to talk to you in person. And I know that some of our listeners are as well, too. We've got a great setup in St. Phillips Plaza. Come on out there and visit at 5:30. You can meet Daniel Hernandez. I think there may be a few other candidates poking around that neck of the woods as well, too. But it's a great opportunity for you to come out and meet the people that are putting their neck out on the line to run for these races for you. And I think no matter where you stand politically, it's safe to say that the Democrat that wins this primary on July 15th, with ballots being mailed out in exactly 2 weeks from today on June 18th. Whoever wins the Democrat primary is going to be a very strong favorite to win the general, correct?
Yep. It's going to be a safe Democratic seat. So it's going to be who can win this primary and then hold it probably for the next 20 years.
Yeah, it's safe to say that in the next 7 weeks, you could become the congressman for CD7 for probably the next couple of decades, right?
That is the hope. So I appreciate the opportunity, Grant, and look forward to seeing you on Monday.
Yeah, same. We look forward to seeing you as well, too. Again, that will be Monday, June 9th, St. Philip's Plaza, 5:30 p.m. Coming out to the center courtyard, you can meet Mr. Daniel Hernandez, candidate for CD7. Daniel, I will let you go. I know you've got to go have an important meeting right now with a House representative. We just appreciate you taking time out of your Wednesday to join us on The Morning Voice.
And I will add... Daniel had to go, but I will add that there is going to be a Democratic primary debate. It's Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, June 10th. It's at 6 p.m., and we are going to have it right here on 1030 The Voice. The Republican debate is on Monday the 9th. That'll be airing right here on 1030 The Voice at 6 p.m. So Monday and Tuesday night, 6 p.m., you can meet your candidates on both sides of the aisle for the CD7 special election primary right here.
Very cool. KVOI coming through, bringing you the local Arizona talk and politics, which is what I love about KVOI. I love getting to do this show with you guys and talk about all things local with respect to Southern Arizona. There's so many ways you can get your federal politics, your state politics. You know, there's so many stations, but where can you come talk about the city council? Where can you talk about the Pima County Board of Supervisors? Where can we talk about Arizona baseball? Right? It's right over here on KVOI, one of my favorite things about this particular show. And we appreciate Mr. Hernandez coming on this show with us as well, too. We're going to have Rich Pfeiffer up in about 7 minutes or so. He's the owner of Gentle Ben's Basio Agave House. You know, really big deal in the restaurant business over there. Kind of controls a good portion of University Boulevard. But there are a couple of restaurant news items to bring up before Rich comes on the show over here. It's a Damo Coffee Shop. Opens up on Broadway. This is part of the Z Block. So think Z Moms, the Ethiopian restaurant on that north side of like the Broadway between Tucson and Country Club area of the street over there. This is part of what will be three establishments in the Z Block, right? They've got an international sports bar. They've got Z Mom's Ethiopian cuisine. And now this particular coffee shop called Zadamo, which is a play off of a type of Ethiopian coffee. And they've opened up this week. And so I'm really excited to see some more things popping up on Broadway. The Sunshine Mile has been slow in its development. There's a lot of parking challenges over there, as we've talked about. But this new coffee shop has just opened up as well. Progress continues to happen on the demolition for the Trader Joe's going in that neighborhood as well, too. So I'm pretty excited to see that one working its way into the block. That's going to be a great thing for the residents of Sam Hughes, Blenman Elm, and even the university students that will have a Trader Joe's and walking distance from that Safeway over there. So like also a super cool thing. The Tucson Botanical Gardens has announced their expansion, and they're acquiring a Japanese plant gallery that's just one block south of them and expanding the Tucson Botanical Gardens. I've always thought it's such a beautiful location, and we've done
a real
few events.
Midtown gem, absolutely.
Truly, and this is at the corner, if you don't know, of Grant and Alvernon, and I know that that's the source of a lot of, you know, jokes and puns and t-shirts and things in Tucson.
200 yards and a breath of fresh air away from that intersection, yeah.
Right, but just south on the southeast corner of Grant and Alvernon, you've got the Tucson Botanical Gardens, and they're growing. They're expanding their footprint, having acquired the Yume Japanese Gardens of Tucson at 2150 North Alvernon. Super cool to see them grow. That's a neat space to do all kinds of events. I've seen weddings and baby showers and all kinds of neat things in the Tucson Botanical Gardens. Definitely like a midtown gem and worth spending part of one of your afternoons, perhaps one of these hot summer days when you could go into the shade and enjoy the butterfly gardens and enjoy some of this neat, you know, humidity and plants that are just so atypical, of course, to the Sonoran Desert. It's certainly an experience that is worth having. The World Margarita Championship coming up in 2 weeks as well, too. That's still on the 14th of June. That's a Saturday night. Saka's putting that one on, and Westward Look. Reforma's going to be there with about 30 different restaurants offering you bites and samples and taste for the absolute best margarita in the entire world. Take note that tickets are $70 or $100 for VIP tickets. You can get those tickets at Sokka's website. This is the Tucson World Margarita Championships on the 14th of June at Westward Look. And the Tucson City of Gastronomy has got a $750,000 grant to bring Tucson City of Gastronomy recipes and food products to your home. I'm not 100% sure how that one is going to work yet. Looking at the newspaper articles, I'm certainly excited to work on this Tucson City of Gastronomy brand and make this one bigger and better. Tucson received that award a little under a decade ago from UNESCO, and it's kind of struggled that branding, I think, since COVID, getting its feet back together. I think the Best Mexican Food in America brand and the Tucson City of Gastronomy brand need to get together and have an unholy love child and pick one and run with that one for us, rather than having two or three or four competing food titles myself. But nonetheless, they've got a $750,000 grant, which should breathe some new life into their operations and allow them to do some more events. They've announced that they've moved that Pueblos de Maíz Festival, which used to be in April, and it's going to be September 24th through September 28th. So excited to participate in that one as Reforma as well, too. That's a really rough time of year for Tucson restaurant businesses. As we've said, September has been pretty much historically our slowest month of the year. All 15 years we've been open at Union Hospitality Group. So anything we can do, Sonoran Restaurant Week, Arizona Restaurant Week, Pueblos de Maíz, all three happening, not shockingly, in September.
It's just like, not in May.
Right, yes.
As we said last, yeah.
Let's not do that the first week of May. Let's do that through the entire month of September. Those are all definitely winners, and they'll be great opportunities for you to go out and support your local restaurants. Well, speaking of local restaurants, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to have local restaurateur Rich Pfeiffer coming up after the break. We're going to talk Gentle Ben's, Bossio, and Agave House. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, on this sunny Wednesday morning, June 4th. You know, when June comes along, you really do need to think about your local Tucson businesses over here. This is a town where we lose an awful lot of people come summertime, right? It's no shocking news-breaking story over here on KVOI to say that. In fact, I'm always disappointed when the news prints articles such as, students are returning, business uptick expected. Like, of course that's going to happen. But we really do dry out quite a bit in the summer, particularly if you're in the fine dining sectors or in the student sectors, right? With so many University of Arizona students leaving, it can be a real negative drag on business. And in the fine dining sector, of course, as so many of our wealthy Tucsonans who can afford houses in other places called not here, think Coronado Island, they're up in Pine Top, they're back east somewhere in the Midwestern United States where I was born and raised, they've got options. And sometimes June or July isn't necessarily your best option. And so I wanted to talk about ways that you could go out and support your local restaurants this summer while we wait for Mr. Rich Pfeiffer to come in and talk about his restaurants on University Boulevard. One is to go out there and buy gift cards. Right? If you're going to spend in some capacity at your local restaurants anyway, it's a great thing to help them out with cash flow. Cash flow is different than the restaurant making a profit. You can absolutely have a business that runs in the black on your tax return for the duration of a calendar year, but runs in the red for the months of the summer. Just to give you a rough idea, in our business, we lose a few hundred thousand dollars operating every single summer. You don't have to cry in your beer for me or your morning coffee over here. We try to make some of that back, of course, in the winter months, but there's some real peaks and valleys into keeping your local restaurants open in the summer and keeping your employees, quite frankly, employed and moving forward in the right direction. And so if you can get out there to any of your local establishments, and these days, most places have gift cards even online, right? The digital or e-gift cards at this point are a big deal. Everybody loves the physical card because you can carry it with you and you could gift it to somebody else a little easier. But with modern POSs these days, the sale of gift cards online is almost universal. There's ne'er a business in Tucson except for the smallest of the small. And even those guys operating on, say, Square POS or one of these small ones have some opportunity for you to go out and buy gift cards. And so if you've got the opportunity to do so, like step out there and buy some local gift cards in June and July. Ray Flores at C. Charo Concepts has always done a big sale actually in July. And I've often thought that was quite genius. I probably need to take advantage of that and do that one myself in some capacity. He's got this big like 50% off gift card sale. And it comes as no surprise that that would happen in the month of July, because this is when restaurants, you know, quite frankly, have this negative cash flow over here. A few shekels like would be very helpful in June or July, more so than they're going to help you out in February and March, where quite frankly, like we have a lot of friends at that time in the business. It's those summer months that we really need things to be awesome over here and ways to dig ourselves out of that hole.
And real quickly, just to echo and to add to what you said, so the trade-off is the heat in the summer. That's bad. That's rough. But it is nice. You can get in to any restaurant you want to go to. They're happy to see you. It's kind of an unexpected bonus. So when you go out, you know, you're not going to have the weight that you have during the snowbird month. So it's a good thing to do. And it's a nice something we get in exchange for putting up with the heat.
Without a doubt. Well, speaking of nice to see, I've got a guest over here in the KVUI studios right now, Mr. Rich Pfeiffer, owner of Gentle Ben's, Bossio, and Agave House. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Grant. Thanks for having me this morning. Sorry, hey, I'm a little bit late.
Oh, no worries. We're just excited to have you over here on this summer morning, Wednesday. Thanks for coming to spend part of your Wednesday with us and talk a little restaurant shop.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you happen to be one of the more dynamic restaurateurs here in Tucson, like growing quite a bit. I mean, you guys pretty much single-handedly control the entire south side north side of University Boulevard.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't necessarily the plan going into it all, but opportunities came around and couldn't say no to it. And I think that's just kind of how I operate.
No, that's awesome. So Gentle Ben's is a pretty storied brand, right? Like this one's been around for an awful long time. Why don't you give our listeners a quick breakdown of Gentle Ben's?
Yeah, Gentle Ben's has been around since 1971. The original location was actually not on University. It was just behind where the Marriott Hotel is. When the Marriott came to town and wanted to build next to the U of A, they wanted the spot where General Ben's was. And so it was in the lease that, you know, General Ben's had to give up that spot for a different location that was in the lease. And it ended up being great. I mean, the old building, I never was in it, but from what I've told, it's just a small, you know, residential house, three stories, not really ideal for a large restaurant or a brewery, which they turned into in 1991 in the old location and then moved over to the current location that's on University.
No, old houses often don't make nice restaurants. And it's one thing I've warned even my friend Randy Dorman, who's doing this Broadway project with the bungalows, like it's going to be tough. Like those floor plans aren't great for that.
Yeah, driving by and just seeing those houses, I'm very curious how it's going to turn out, because I could definitely see a lot of challenges there.
Right. You don't have the open dining room space. You don't have the proper kitchen space. Like the layout is just not conducive to it.
And I imagine you're not allowed to knock down walls as you want to.
Yes, often a problem as well, yeah. Too. Something you probably know all mm-hmm. about doing many of these big restaurant TIs over there on mm-hmm. University. Now, you used to work as a bartender at Gentle Ben's with my wife, correct?
I did. We worked together for a few years bartending, and even before that, I was probably her bar back.
Oh, very nice. I'm still her bar back to this day. Katarina, if you're listening, I will scrub plates and glassware for you, take out the bus tubs, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely. She's awesome to work with.
No, it's one of the great things about the restaurant business is that often the most successful operators are guys that literally came from the bottom of the industry, right?
Restaurants are a different beast, and I think some people get into it without ever working in it, thinking it's a sexy industry, and there's definitely some sexiness to it, but there's a lot of hard work and a lot of grind and a lot of parts that people don't see.
Without a doubt, and if you don't have experience in that one, I think you can come in really, really unprepared. On the first hour, we were talking about how EG's was purchased by this Gladstone Capital Corporation, right? Like a big REIT that is buying all these companies and, you know, private equity and restructuring them. And I have some real worries about their ability to operate a 25-restaurant franchise.
Yeah, you know, Ichi's a Tucson staple, and when it was privately owned, was doing awesome, and I think it's had some speed bumps since then.
Without a doubt. But you guys haven't had any speed bumps at all. I feel like it's just been full throttle ahead for your group over here, because you were able to take down the corner of Park and University and build a Mexican concept over there as well.
Yeah, that project, it was a lot of fun. So with General Benz, it was an established, successful business. With Baccio, it was an established business. It wasn't necessarily our idea through and through. And so Agave House was fun to see if we could do it from ground up. Tore everything down, rebuilt it back up, hired an entire staff, trained, created a menu. Completely different experience than going in and buying an existing business.
Without a doubt. Having done both, can I ask you, like, how much money goes into like an Agave House remodel, more or less? Like, give me a rough number.
We spent a lot more than we should have and needed to.
A very political answer there.
we spent $1.5 million, and if it was our first restaurant, we probably would have been in trouble. But it turned out beautiful, and I'm proud of what it turned out to, and very happy that we went through the way that it turned out. But I will say we learned a lot along the way, and if I were to do it again, I would make a lot of different choices.
Well, the construction of restaurants is something that just most people don't understand, just how expensive it can be, right? When you're talking about building a kitchen, you know, you could put $1 million into a restaurant kitchen very, very easily, and not one guest appreciates it.
Mm-mm.
Nobody looks at your 4-rack Hobart dish machine, you know, with conveyor belt in the kitchen and goes, oh my God, honey, they can do, you know, 780 pint glasses an hour out of this bad boy. You know, it just, unless you're a real dork, of course.
Yeah, we spend about a third of that just on equipment.
Yeah, it makes total sense to me. I get it. And how's it going over there at Agave House?
It's good. Summertime, but in the school year is good. This last semester, we saw big increases in food and alcohol sales and, you know, just getting more traffic in the door.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a quick break over here, but when we come back, we've got a couple more segments with Richard Pfeiffer, owner of Agave House, General Benz, and Bossio Italian. We're going to talk about restaurant business in the summer in Tucson, some of the challenges we go through, particularly operators such as Richard, where you're on university, right? Like where you've got like a real drain of students and how you keep those things going to make it through a summer to get to those awesome times. And we're going to touch on the nightclub business as well too, because you guys have had a lot of success in nightlife and fun and shenanigans, a real great rebirth over there. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Richard Pfeiffer on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk.
And if you'd like to watch along with listen, we're running this interview on Facebook. Go to 10:30 The Voice on Facebook, hit the like button, and watch this interview with Richard Pfeiffer from General Benz, Baccio, and Agave House.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, and we are joined for another segment by Mr. Richard Pfeiffer, owner of General Benz, Bossio, and Agave House. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you.
Hey, so before the break, we were talking about, you know, how you ended up with three restaurants here on University, and you've really done, I think since COVID, like a great job in revitalizing both the brand of General Benz, the energy, and the nightlife as well, too. How'd you do that? Break that down for us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, coming out of COVID, it was hard for a lot of restaurants. It ended up being pretty good for the people on University. U of A brought all the college kids back. It was not a fun time, you know, but it helped pay the bills. But in that time frame of just before COVID until just after COVID, a lot of high rises were built behind us. And so a lot of that traffic got a lot closer to us. It wasn't very far away in the neighborhoods behind or in the dorms, but that has definitely been a part of why we decided to do more and gain more locations on University. But then I think our methods of attracting people for nightlife kind of changed a little bit. And there's lots of competition. There's always competition. And I've worked there since 2009 before being an owner. And I saw nightlife come and go and come and go and come and go. And so in my mind, seeing what worked and what didn't work, and to me, it was about creating relationships with promoters and incentivizing them a little bit more, you know, throwing a little bit of money behind it before when we didn't and their loyalty wasn't necessarily there. And so half of it's the relationships with the people that you're trying to get in, half of it's finding the right people.
No, so just describe how this relationship with promoters works. You're talking about like third-party individuals that essentially are paid some semblance of commission for helping drive the nightlife business?
Yep, and so most of them are in Greek Life at the U of A or some kind of social organization, not necessarily Greek Life. And they're going to have the connections with people and the ability to reach out and tell people, hey, this is going to be the fun place to be tonight. And you know, we've had seasons where we've had the wrong promoters, where we didn't find the right people, and we've had seasons where we found the right promoters, and it's been very successful.
Do you think those promoters change then every year? Because if they're university students, right, they're kind of moving up the ladder and eventually graduating. I imagine they probably don't stick around like the movie Old School and like a 35-year-old like club promoter.
No, that wouldn't work out. You know, sometimes a fifth-year senior will even try to do it, but you know, they don't have the social connection as someone who's a fourth in their fourth year. And going into the beginning of the semester in August, your 21-year-olds are only seniors. And so it limits you to just having seniors. And then you have really about a 6-month attention span is what I have found. And then people start to get used to and, kind of take advantage of the privileges. And then, you know, getting a fresh face in there, turns that around.
So what do you do from like a security standpoint, given that you're so close to student housing and there's a lot of 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds that would love to experience the hospitality of Gentle Ben's on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night? Like, what are you doing to prevent that?
Yeah, so we have a great reputation on university of not allowing 21 or under 21-year-olds in, and that helps a lot. It deters a lot of people from even trying. We have pretty consistent guys throughout the years on the door checking IDs. And when you're checking, you know, 1,000, 2,000 IDs a night, you start to feel exactly what a real ID is. And then when you get a fake one, it's completely different, right? And so then obviously we have the book and we do training, in-house training, and, you know, just do all that we can. You know, sometimes someone's probably going to slip in with their older brother's ID, their older sister's ID. But we try to do our due diligence and, you know, not only for the liability and legal standpoint, but for the college seniors, they don't want to go to a place where there's freshmen drinking there as well. So
I love when the security staff becomes so good at checking IDs that they're literally like savants, that like just the feel of it, in the same way a banker can tell a fake $100 bill in a matter of a second just by looking at it, people know that about IDs as well too.
Yeah, sometimes we have door staff, the customer pull the ID out, not even getting it to the hands of the security guard. And they're like, nope, that's fake.
Yeah, it's an impressive skill set and one that's earned, right? Forged over time because you've really got to be in the industry and do that a lot to get that one down. But there's always the problem with somebody using someone else's ID, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to be a real ID. That's going to pass any sort of scanner, any sort of checker. It's on you to determine whether that person handing you that ID is actually the person. And that's no easy feat either when you've got older brothers and sisters.
Yeah, we have gone back and forth with the scanner because sometimes it gives a false sense of security because most fake IDs do scan now. It's great for a liability standpoint, knowing who's there, what time people came in and things like that, and covering yourself from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, and we use the scanners in our establishments at the Maverick and Union, partially for that reason as well, too. I agree with you. It can give you a false sense of, well, this is real, because there's so many fake IDs out there right now that can pass through the scanner. We've got one that will connect now to the DMV databases of over 40 U.S. states, and it costs you 50 cents every time you push the check button. There's a fee for everything, right? But it will allow us to check that ID against DMV databases. So when you get those uncomfortable situations where they're saying, this is my ID, this is real, call the cops, but you don't exactly want police presence with lights on in front of your establishment at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, that's worth 50 cents or a dollar in a fee to push a button and check that on the DMV database. And normally just the threat of that will drive away some of those fake IDs at that point.
What's funny is how many people that doesn't turn away, for at least like the people on university. We have cops along university most of the nights, which is a nice advantage that we have. But someone will argue their ID is real. And we've had people literally go to a cop with their fake ID and say, hey, this is real.
Right. I mean, you got to shoot your shot, right? Just walk in there with confidence. Fake it till you make it, I guess. Yeah. Is that what's happening over here at Gentle Ben's? That's unbelievable. But it happens. But you guys have done a pretty good job of having a police presence that's there, but not so heavy-handed to take away from the fun as well, too. How do you maintain that balance?
We have great relationship with the police that are on the street. We've developed relationships with people, some of them been there a long time, over the last decade probably. And, you know, when they interact with our security staff, we'll let them come in if they want to. And I think the fact that they're there all the time, it's just a thing. It doesn't scare anybody away.
No, I get it. And I think that that's helpful. And downtown needs even a little bigger presence, I think, than what they have right now with that. How do you compete against all these clubs downtown as well, too? As you said, there's always going to be competition. But there just seems to be an awful lot of nightclub spaces downtown as opposed to restaurants. Most of them are bars that maybe play a restaurant every once in a while rather than restaurant playing bar.
Yeah. It is tough. And I think it goes back to just finding that good promoter team. And finding the right people and then asking the right questions and trying to get people to be honest. Because sometimes you ask people, you know, what are you doing right? What are you doing wrong? And they tell you what you want to hear. And so trying to get in and find out more of the things they don't want to tell you sometimes, I think is super helpful. As I get older, I don't know exactly what a college kid wants anymore. And I think it's important to realize that.
I mean, it's such a different world out there right now when you don't necessarily need a night spot to meet people. You've got the Tinders, you know, and the various, you know, dating apps that would have seemed so weird to me 20 years ago are now just the norm. Do you have to go to a social establishment to meet people in 2025?
And I would also say that their attention span is a lot shorter than it used to be. And so it used to be college kids always bar hop. They go from one place to the next, and they never start and finish in the same place, or not very often. But we used to have them for like two and a half hours, and now the norm seems to be about an hour and a half. And we kind of touched on this earlier. We're getting the same amount of people throughout the door, but those people are drinking less throughout the day. Like, we can have a packed bar at capacity where, you know, before we need 8, 9, 10 bartenders, and now we need 5 or 6.
Interesting. So you think that the younger folks are just drinking less in general?
I do think they're drinking a lot less.
And is that because of the proliferation of other intoxicants?
I think that is half of the battle. I think the other half is social media and the fear that they're going to do something stupid, have their picture taken, and have it put out on social media for everybody to see.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that aspect. So it's actually just a fear of ridicule in some capacity that your shenanigans would be posted for others. And that fear is preventing people from becoming intoxicated, I guess. What an interesting social dynamic.
I think when I was 21, there was probably pictures that I would have been embarrassed to have put out everywhere. As you get older, you're like, yeah, I don't care. But, you know, when you're 21, those things matter.
I may or may not have to ask my wife for some of those pictures over there of General Ben's
back in the day. She has some.
But you guys are doing a great job of operating these establishments. To have three right next to each other, you know, it's kind of a similar situation. Like, you and I have a lot of similarities in same shopping center, a pub, an Italian restaurant, and a Mexican restaurant, right? Like, there's some similar formulas over there. But we're in St. Philip's Plaza, I think, is a little more evergreen in the sense that you know, some of the residents stick around in the summer. Like on University Boulevard, like, there is a much bigger drop naturally because so many of the college students go home, no?
Yeah. At General Ben's, we're doing about 20% of the business that we would do in a peak month.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Why don't we take a quick break and we'll talk about that when we come back after the break, the successes and challenges of operating businesses on University Boulevard in the summer. You're talking all things restaurant business with us over here, Mr. Rich Pfeiffer from General Ben's Bossio and Agave House, and Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, and we've got one more segment with the dynamic Rich Pfeiffer, owner of General Ben's Bossio and Agave House on University Boulevard. Rich, you were telling us before the break that you would do 20% of the sales on a normal, say, weekend night in the summer weekend night. Is it that big of a drop-off?
It's huge. So everything that we do revolves around events at the U of A. Not necessarily U of A students, but you have faculty and staff, shows at Centennial Hall, which luckily Broadway of Tucson has 3 shows this summer. Mamma Mia was awesome. It was the week after graduation. And then we have 1 in June and 1 in early August, I believe. And so that'll be a big boost to this summer. I know they don't particularly like it because it's harder for them to sell tickets in the summertime than it would be in the spring or the fall. But there's not a lot of tourism in Tucson. And that is a lot of what drives university as well. We have the 2 hotels, a lot of conferences that happen. And obviously, parents visiting their kids is a big part of our business. So, you know, with all of that, it all kind of dries up and we have to weather the storm. And it can be challenging.
How do you staff for that one? When you got a kitchen staff built to do X and you do 0.25 of X, like, can you keep them all? Do they leave for the summer? How does that work?
So our dishwashers, we hire seasonally and we try to be very transparent because we'd never just want to pull the plug on somebody. Most of the front of house staff are students and a good portion of them leave over the summertime and it works out. They have to stay through graduation. They have to come back 2 weeks before school starts. But other than that, they can leave for the summer and have their job when they come back. It works out well for both parties. But for management and kitchen staff, for the most part, we just have to spend a lot of extra money over the summer for two reasons. One, training a bunch of staff in the beginning of August would be next to impossible. And then to have a good product on the other side, it just wouldn't happen. But then two, like, it's people's livelihoods. And so I don't want to just, pull the rug out from under somebody like that.
Without a doubt, certainly a big challenge. But one thing that you guys have done so well is really turn that upper deck of Gentle Ben's into like the happening place over there. I mean, there are LED walls, TVs. It's a great place to watch sports, but it's also a fun place to go see a DJ and have a bit of a club experience too, no?
Yeah, it's pretty quiet over the summertime. We do a handful of events with Relentless Beats and ticketed shows with DJs over the summer, which brings in more of a local crowd. No, we do it year round, but it's a lot nicer in the summertime it stands out more.
How many ticketed shows do you think you do a year, more or less?
Probably around 25.
Wow. Okay. That's a pretty big amount. We've been considering that over in the St. Philip's Plaza area. It's a little tougher because the ingress egress is harder to control, but in getting even higher quality bands and acts, like at some point you just can't sell enough food and beverage to pay for that artist. If the artist wants $20,000 to play or 25 grand or something, you just can't make that up in Coors Light sales.
Yeah. It's definitely difficult. And we've tried it a few times by ourselves and have lost money. And so the partnership with Relentless Beats is awesome. They take care of the artists and the ticket sales, and we take care of drinks, and both parties are happy. You know, it's something they're really good at.
Sure. Yeah, we work with that at the Maverick as well, too, with a couple different promoters that bring us, not DJs like how you guys might do, but live country shows, Red Dirt, Texas acts working their way through the southwestern United States in sort of routed shows where they play this bar in Albuquerque this day and this bar in Colorado the next day and this bar in West Texas and so on and so forth. So we're part of a couple circuits. I imagine you've probably got something like that with Relentless.
Yep, something very similar. They do New Mexico shows, Tucson shows, Phoenix shows.
And are people okay with ticketed like events like at the brewery? Are they showing up like to get a hamburger and a pint and then saying, "What the heck, Rich? You're charging me at the door to walk in this place."
So luckily we have two floors, which works out well for all aspects of nightlife and restaurant in the same place. We do a little bit of nightlife at Agave House with one floor, and it has a lot of complications that we have to work through. And we know that there's some guests coming in at, 8 or 9 o'clock for dinner, but the experience is going to change by 10 o'clock. And so we don't have to really do that with Gentle Ben's. We can be at capacity upstairs and it can be quiet in the dining room.
Yeah, I actually hadn't thought about that aspect of the two-story one. I've always been afraid of two-story restaurants, having worked in a pair of them in my life. I've promised myself, like, Grant, you will never do another two-story restaurant again, having schlepped things up and down the stairs. Every time someone asks for a side of ranch, you get the opportunity to get a Stairmaster workout over here, only to be sent for a second side of ranch.
Yeah, there's definitely challenges with it. I mean, just being big in general has its challenges. Over at Baccio, it's a much more intimate space, and you can stand between the kitchen and the bar, and you can see the entire floor and know what's going on. There's so many hiding places at Gentle Ben's that you can't do that.
No, without a doubt. Well, we've only got about a minute and some change left over here. Why don't we break down where our guests can interact with you? Give us the socials, the addresses, ways to interact with Gentle Ben's, Baccio, and Agave House.
Yeah, gentlebens.com, BaccioTucson.com, AgaveHouseTucson.com. Or all of our websites. We are on Instagram and Facebook. And one thing I'd like to touch on before we get off the air is parking. There is parking in the garage, validated Monday through Friday after 5 o'clock. Unfortunately, they started charging for street parking after 5 o'clock and on the weekends, but we still validate after 5 o'clock and on the weekends. So come in, eat with us. get a validation, and that parking will be free.
Very cool. Validated parking over here on these great spots on North University. That should be music to the ears of so many people that were upset about the city of Tucson starting to charge for parking on the weekends now, right? They moved that time from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. on the weekdays, and they're charging for Saturdays as well, too, now downtown, right?
Yeah, I went to the couple Park Tucson meetings, and their reasoning I just didn't agree with. For me, it's the perception of being able to park for free is going to bring somebody down there. There's 70 parking spots on University. That's not feeding any business.
Nope. I have to agree. Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your Wednesday to come join us on The Morning Voice. Listeners, if you get an opportunity, go down and get your parking validated and go visit General Ben's, Basio, and Agave House. And the wonderful Mr. Pfeiffer, thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Awesome to be on the show.
And listeners, thanks again for a great show. It was awesome to have Daniel Hernandez, candidate for CD7. He's running for Congress. You can meet him at St. Philip's Plaza Monday, June 9th, 5:30 p.m. I will be there with bells on as well, too. It's been amazing to get to spend part of this day with you over here. Kathleen Wynn coming up next. Don't go anywhere.